Listening Library presents Magnus Chase and the Gods of Asgard, Book 3, The Ship of the Dead, by Rick Riordan. Read for you by Michael Crouch. Chapter 1. Percy Jackson does his level best to kill me. "Try it again," Percy told me. "This time with less dying." Standing on the yardarm of the USS Constitution, looking down at Boston Harbor 200 feet below, I wished I had the natural defenses of a turkey buzzard. Then I could projectile vomit on Percy Jackson and make him go away. The last time he'd made me try this jump, only an hour before, I'd broken every bone in my body. My friend Alex Fierro had rushed me back to the Hotel Valhalla just in time for me to die in my own bed. Unfortunately, I was an Enheri, one of Odin's immortal warriors. I couldn't die permanently as long as I expired within the boundaries of Valhalla. 30 minutes later, I woke up as good as new. Now here I was again, ready for more pain. Hooray! "Is this strictly necessary?" I asked. Percy leaned against the rigging, the wind rippling little waves through his black hair. He looked like a normal guy. Orange t-shirt, jeans, battered white leather Reeboks. If you saw him walking down the street, you wouldn't think, "Hey look, a demigod son of Poseidon, praise the Olympians." He didn't have gills or webbed fingers, though his eyes were sea green, about the same shade I imagined my face was just then. The only strange thing about Jackson was the tattoo on the inside of his forearm, a trident as dark as seared wood, with a single line underneath and the letters SPQR. He told me the letters stood for Sono Pazzi Quelli Romani. Those Romans are crazy. I wasn't sure if he was kidding. "Look, Magnus," he told me, "you'll be sailing across hostile territory. A bunch of sea monsters and sea gods and who knows what else will be trying to kill you, right?" "Yeah, I suppose." By which I meant, "Please don't remind me. Please leave me alone." "At some point," said Percy, "you're going to get thrown off the boat, maybe from as high up as this. You'll need to know how to survive the impact, avoid drowning, and get back to the surface ready to fight. That's going to be tough, especially in cold water." I knew he was right. From what my cousin Annabeth had told me, Percy had been through even more dangerous adventures than I had, and I lived in Valhalla. I died at least once a day. As much as I appreciated him coming up from New York to offer me heroic aquatic survival tips, though, I was getting tired of failing. Yesterday, I'd gotten chomped by a great white shark, strangled by a giant squid, and stung by 1,000 irate moon jellies. I'd swallowed several gallons of seawater trying to hold my breath, and learned that I was no better at hand-to-hand combat 30 feet down than I was on dry land. This morning, Percy had walked me around Old Ironsides, trying to teach me the basics of sailing and navigation, but I still couldn't tell the mizzenmast from the poop deck. Now here I was, a failure at falling off a pole. I glanced down, where Annabeth and Alex Fierro were watching us from the deck. "You got this, Magnus!" Annabeth cheered. Alex Fierro gave me 2 thumbs up. At least I think that was the gesture. It was hard to be sure from this distance. Percy took a deep breath. He'd been patient with me so far, but I could tell the stress of the weekend was starting to get to him, too. Whenever he looked at me, his left eye twitched. "It's cool, man," he promised. "I'll demonstrate again, okay? Start in skydiver position, spread eagle to slow your descent. Then, right before you hit the water, straighten like an arrow. Head up, heels down, back straight, butt clenched. That last part is really important." "Skydiver," I said. "Eagle, arrow, butt." "Right," Percy said. "Watch me." He jumped from the yardarm, falling toward the harbor in perfect spread eagle form. At the last moment, he straightened, heels downward, and hit the water, disappearing with hardly a ripple. A moment later, he surfaced, his palms raised like, "See? Nothing to it." Annabeth and Alex applauded.
"Okay, Magnus," Alex called up to me. "Your turn. Be a man."
I suppose that was meant to be funny. Most of the time, Alex identified as female, but today he was definitely male. Sometimes I slipped up and used the wrong pronouns for him, her, so Alex liked to return the favor by teasing me mercilessly. Because friendship. Annabeth hollered,
"You got this, cuz!"
Below me, the dark surface of the water glinted like a freshly scrubbed waffle iron, ready to squash me flat. "Right," I muttered to myself. I jumped. For half a second, I felt pretty confident. The wind whistled past my ears. I spread my arms and managed not to scream. "Okay," I thought. "I can do this." Which was when my sword, Jack, decided to fly up out of nowhere and start a conversation.
"Hey, senor!"
His runes glowed along his double-edged blade.
"What you doing?"
I flailed, trying to turn vertical for impact.
"Jack, not now!" "Oh, I get it! You're falling! You know, one time Frey and I were falling..."
Before he could continue his fascinating story, I slammed into the water. Just as Percy had warned, the cold stunned my system. I sank, momentarily paralyzed, the air knocked out of my lungs. My ankles throbbed like I'd bounced off a brick trampoline. But at least I wasn't dead. I scanned for major injuries. When you're an Inherji, you get pretty good at listening to your own pain. You can stagger around the battlefield in Valhalla, mortally wounded, gasping your last breath, and calmly think, "Oh, so that's what a crushed ribcage feels like. Interesting." This time, I'd broken my left ankle for sure. The right one was only sprained. Easy fix. I summoned the power of Frey. Warmth, like summer sunlight, spread from my chest into my limbs. The pain subsided. I wasn't as good at healing myself as I was at healing others, but I felt my ankles beginning to mend, as if a swarm of friendly wasps were crawling around inside my flesh, mud-daubing the fractures, re-knitting the ligaments. "Ah, better," I thought, as I floated through the cold darkness. "Now, there's something else I should be doing. Oh, right. Breathing." Jack's hilt nudged against my hand like a dog looking for attention. I wrapped my fingers around his leather grip, and he hauled me upward, launching me out of the harbor like a rocket-powered Lady of the Lake. I landed, gasping and shivering, on the deck of Old Ironsides next to my friends.
"Whoa!"
Percy stepped back.
"That was different. You okay, Magnus?"
"Fine,"
I coughed out, sounding like a duck with a chest cold. Percy eyed the glowing runes on my weapon.
"Where'd the sword come from?"
"Hi, I'm Jack," said Jack.
Annabelle stifled a yelp.
"It talks?"
"It?"
Jack demanded.
"Hey, lady, some respect. I'm Sumar Brander, the Sword of Summer, the Weapon of Frey. I've been around for thousands of years. Also, I'm a dude."
Annabeth frowned.
"Magnus, when you told me about your magic sword, did you perhaps fail to mention that he can speak?"
"Did I?" Honestly, I couldn't remember. The past few weeks, Jack had been off on his own, doing whatever sentient magic swords did in their free time. Percy and I had been using standard-issue Hotel Valhalla practice blades for sparring. It hadn't occurred to me that Jack might fly in out of nowhere and introduce himself. Besides, the fact that Jack talked was the least weird thing about him. The fact that he could sing the entire cast recording of Jersey Boys from memory, that was weird. Alex Fierro looked like he was trying not to laugh. He was wearing pink and green today, as usual, though I'd never seen this particular outfit before. Lace-up leather boots, ultra-skinny rose jeans, an untucked lime dress shirt, and a checkered skinny tie as loose as a necklace. With his thick black Ray-Bans and his choppy green hair, he looked like he'd stepped off a New Wave album cover circa 1979.
"Be polite, Magnus," he said. "Introduce your friends to your sword."
Right, I said. "Jack, this is Percy and Annabeth. They're demigods. The Greek kind."
"Hmm."
Jack didn't sound impressed.
"I met Hercules once."
"Who hasn't?" Annabeth muttered.
"Fair point," Jack said. "But I suppose if you're friends of Magnus's..."
He went completely still. His runes faded. Then he leaped out of my hand and flew toward Annabeth, his blade twitching as if he was sniffing the air.
"Where is she? Where are you hiding the babe?"
Annabeth backed toward the rail.
"Whoa there, sword. Personal space."
"Jack, behave," Alex said. "What are you doing?"
"She's around here somewhere," Jack insisted.
He flew to Percy.
"Aha! What's in your pocket, sea boy?"
"Excuse me?"
Percy looked a bit nervous about the magical sword hovering at his waistline. Alex lowered his Ray-Bans.
"Okay, now I'm curious. What do you have in your pocket, Percy? Inquiring swords want to know."
Percy pulled a plain-looking ballpoint pen from his jeans.
"You mean this?"
"Bam!" Jack said. "Who is this vision of loveliness?"
"Jack," I said. "It's a pen."
"No, it's not. Show me. Show me."
Sure.
Percy uncapped the pen. Immediately, it transformed into a 3-foot-long sword with a leaf-shaped blade of glowing bronze. Compared to Jack, the weapon looked delicate, almost petite. But from the way Percy wielded it, I had no doubt he'd be able to hold his own on the battlefields of Valhalla with that thing. Jack turned his point toward me, his runes flashing burgundy.
"See, Magnus? I told you it wasn't stupid to carry a sword disguised as a pen."
"Jack, I never said that," I protested.
"You did."
Percy raised an eyebrow.
"What are you two talking about?"
"Nothing," I said hastily. "So I guess this is the famous Riptide? Annabeth told me about it."
"Her?"
Jack corrected. Annabeth frowned.
"Percy's sword is a she?"
Jack laughed.
"Well, duh."
Percy studied Riptide, though I could have told him from experience that it was almost impossible to tell a sword's gender by looking at it.
"I don't know," he said. "Are you sure?"
"Percy," said Alex, "respect the gender."
"Okay, fine," he said. "It's just kind of strange that I never knew."
"On the other hand," Annabeth said, "you didn't know the pen could write until last year."
"That's low, wise girl."
"Anyway," Jack interrupted, "the important thing is Riptide's here now. She's beautiful, and she's met me. Maybe the two of us can, you know, have some private time to talk about, sword stuff."
Alex smirked.
"That sounds like a wonderful idea. How about we let the swords get to know each other while the rest of us have lunch? Magnus, do you think you can handle eating falafel without choking?"
Chapter 2. Falafel sandwiches with a side order of Ragnarok. We ate on the aft spar deck. Look at me with the nautical terms. After a hard morning of failing, I felt like I'd really earned my deep-fried chickpea patties and pita bread, my yogurt and chilled cucumber slices, and my side order of extra-spicy lamb kebabs. Annabeth had arranged our picnic lunch. She knew me too well. My clothes dried quickly in the sunlight. The warm breeze felt good on my face. Sailboats traced their way across the harbor, while airplanes cut across the blue sky, heading out from Logan Airport to New York or California or Europe. The whole city of Boston seemed charged with impatient energy, like a classroom at 2:59 p.m., waiting for the dismissal bell, everybody ready to get out of town for the summer and enjoy the good weather. Me? All I wanted to do was stay put. Riptide and Jack stood propped nearby in a coil of rope, their hilts leaning against the gunnery rail. Riptide acted like your typical inanimate object, but Jack kept inching closer, chatting her up, his blade glowing the same dark bronze as hers. Fortunately, Jack was used to holding one-sided conversations. He joked, he flattered, he name-dropped like a maniac. "You know, Thor and Odin and I were at this tavern one time." If Riptide was impressed, she didn't show it. Percy wadded up his falafel wrapper. Along with being a water breather, the dude also had the ability to inhale food. "So," he said, "when do you guys sail out?" Alex raised an eyebrow at me like, "Yeah, Magnus, when do we sail out?" I'd been trying to avoid this topic with Fierro for the past 2 weeks, without much luck. "Soon," I said. "We don't exactly know where we're headed, or how long it'll take to get there." "Story of my life," said Percy. "But we have to find Loki's big nasty ship of death before it sails at Midsummer. It's docked somewhere along the border between Niflheim and Jotunheim. We're estimating it'll take a couple of weeks to sail that distance." "Which means," Alex said, "we really should have left already. We definitely have to sail by the end of the week, ready or not." In his dark lenses, I saw the reflection of my own worried face. We both knew we were as far from ready as we were from Niflheim. Annabeth tucked her feet underneath her. Her long blonde hair was tied back in a ponytail. Her dark blue t-shirt was emblazoned with the yellow words, "College of Environmental Design, UC Berkeley." "Heroes never get to be ready, do we?" she said. "We just do the best we can." Percy nodded. "Yep, usually it works out. We haven't died yet."
"Though you keep trying."
Annabeth elbowed him. Percy put his arm around her. She nestled comfortably against his side. He kissed the blonde curls on the top of her head. This show of affection made my heart do a painful little twist. I was glad to see my cousin so happy, but it reminded me how much was at stake if I failed to stop Loki. Alex and I had already died. We would never age. We'd live in Valhalla until Doomsday came around, unless we got killed outside the hotel before that. The best life we could hope for was training for Ragnarok, postponing that inevitable battle as many centuries as possible, and then one day marching out of Valhalla with Odin's army and dying a glorious death while the nine worlds burned around us. Fun. But Annabeth and Percy had a chance for a normal life. They'd already made it through high school, which Annabeth told me was the most dangerous time for Greek demigods. In the fall, they'd go off to college on the West Coast. If they made it through that, they had a decent chance of surviving adulthood. They could live in the mortal world without monsters attacking them every 5 minutes. Unless my friends and I failed to stop Loki, in which case the world, all the worlds, would end in a few weeks. But, you know, no pressure. I set down my pita sandwich. Even falafel could only do so much to lift my spirits. "What about you guys?" I asked. "Straight back to New York today?" "Yeah," Percy said. "I got a babysit tonight. I'm psyched." "That's right," I remembered. "Your new baby sister." Yet another important life hanging in the balance, I thought. But I managed to smile. "Congratulations, man. What's her name?"
"Estelle. It was my grandmother's name. On my mom's side, obviously. Not Poseidon's."
"I approve," Alex said. old-fashioned and elegant. Estelle Jackson. Well, Estelle Blofus, Percy corrected. My stepdad is Paul Blofus. Not much I can do about that surname, but my little sis is awesome. 5 fingers, 5 toes, 2 eyes. She drools a lot.
Just like her brother, Annabeth said.
Alex laughed. I could totally imagine Percy bouncing baby Estelle in his arms, singing Under the Sea from The Little Mermaid. That made me feel even more miserable. Somehow, I had to buy little Estelle enough decades to have a proper life. I had to find Loki's demonic ship full of zombie warriors, stop it from sailing off into battle and triggering Ragnarok, then recapture Loki and put him back in chains so he couldn't cause any more world-burning mischief. Or at least, not as much world-burning mischief. Hey, Alex threw a piece of pita at me. Stop looking so glum. Sorry. I tried to appear more cheerful. It wasn't as easy as mending my ankle by sheer force of will. I'm looking forward to meeting Estelle someday, when we get back from our quest. And I appreciate you guys coming up to Boston. Really. Percy glanced over at Jack, who was still chatting up Riptide. Sorry I couldn't be more help. The sea is... He shrugged. Kinda unpredictable. Alex stretched his legs. At least Magnus fell a lot better the second time. If worse comes to worst, I can always turn into a dolphin and save his sorry butt. The corner of Percy's mouth twitched. You can turn into a dolphin? I'm a child of Loki. Want to see? No, I believe you. Percy gazed into the distance. I've got a friend named Frank who's a shapeshifter. He does dolphins. Also giant goldfish. I shuddered, imagining Alex Fierro as a giant pink and green koi. We'll make do. We've got a good team. That's important, Percy agreed. Probably more important than having sea skills. He straightened and furrowed his eyebrows. Annabeth unfolded herself from his side.
Uh-oh. I know that look. You've got an idea.
Something my dad told me. Percy rose. He walked over to his sword, interrupting Jack in the middle of a fascinating tale about the time he'd embroidered a giant's bowling bag. Percy picked up Riptide and studied her blade.
Hey, man, Jack complained. We were just starting to hit it off.
Sorry, Jack.
From his pocket, Percy pulled out his pen cap and touched it to the tip of his sword. With a faint shink, Riptide shrank back into a ballpoint.
Poseidon and I had this conversation about weapons one time. He told me that all sea gods have one thing in common. They're really vain and possessive when it comes to their magic items.
Annabeth rolled her eyes.
That sounds like every god we've met.
True. Percy said. But sea gods even more so. Triton sleeps with his conch shell trumpet. Galatea spends most of her time polishing her magic seahorse saddle. And my dad is super paranoid about losing his trident.
I thought about my one and only encounter with a Norse sea goddess.
It hadn't gone well. Ran had promised to destroy me if I ever sailed into her waters again. But she had been obsessed with her magical nets and the junk collection that swirled inside them. Because of that, I'd been able to trick her into giving me my sword.
You're saying I'll have to use their own stuff against them, I guessed.
Right, Percy confirmed. Also, what you said about having a good team. Sometimes being the son of a sea god hasn't been enough to save me, even underwater. One time, my friend Jason and I got pulled to the bottom of the Mediterranean by the storm goddess, Kimopalea. I was useless. Jason saved my butt by offering to make trading cards and action figures of her.
Alex almost choked on his falafel.
What?
The point is, Percy continued, Jason knew nothing about the ocean. He saved me anyway. It was kind of embarrassing.
Annabeth smirked.
I guess so. I never heard the details about that.
Percy's ears turned as pink as Alex's jeans.
Anyway, maybe we've been looking at this all wrong. I've been trying to teach you sea skills, but the most important thing is to use whatever you've got on hand. Your team, your wits, the enemy's own magical stuff.
And there's no way to plan for that, I said.
Exactly, Percy said.
My work here is done. Annabeth frowned.
Percy, you're saying the best plan is no plan. As a child of Athena, I can't really endorse that.
Yeah, Alex said. And personally, I still like my plan of turning into a sea mammal. Percy raised his hands.
All I'm saying is the most powerful demigod of our generation is sitting right here, and it isn't me.
He nodded to Annabeth.
Wise girl can't shapeshift or breathe underwater or talk to Pegasi. She can't fly, and she isn't super strong. But she's crazy smart and good at improvising. That's what makes her deadly. Doesn't matter whether she's on land, in water, in the air, or in Tartarus. Magnus, you were training with me all weekend. I think you should have been training with Annabeth instead.
Annabeth's stormy gray eyes were hard to read. At last, she said,
Okay, that was sweet.
She kissed Percy on the cheek. Alex nodded. Not bad, seaweed brain.
Don't you start with that nickname, too, Percy muttered.
From the wharf came the deep rumbling sound of warehouse doors rolling open. Voices echoed off the sides of the buildings. That's our cue to leave, I said. This ship just got back from dry dock. They're reopening it to the public tonight in a big ceremony.
Yeah, Alex said.
The glamour won't obscure our presence once the whole crew is aboard. Percy arched an eyebrow.
Glamour? You mean like your outfit?
Alex snorted. No, glamour as in illusion magic. It's the force that clouds the vision of regular mortals.
Huh, Percy said. We call that the mist.
Annabeth rapped her knuckles on Percy's head.
Whatever we call it, we'd better hurry. Help me clean up.
We reached the bottom of the gangplank just as the first sailors were arriving. Jack floated along ahead of us, glowing different colors and singing Walk Like a Man in a terrible falsetto. Alex changed form from a cheetah to a wolf to a flamingo. He does a great flamingo. The sailors gave us blank looks and a wide berth, but nobody challenged us. Once we were clear of the docks, Jack turned into a runestone pendant. He dropped into my hand, and I reattached him to the chain around my neck. It wasn't like him to shut up so suddenly. I figured he was miffed about his date with Riptide being cut short. As we strolled down Constitution Road, Percy turned to me.
What was that back there? The shape-shifting, the singing sword? Were you trying to get caught?
Nah, I said. If you flaunt the weird magical stuff, it confuses mortals even more. It felt good to be able to teach him something. It kind of short-circuits mortal brains, makes them avoid you.
Huh.
Annabeth shook her head.
All these years sneaking around, and we could have just been ourselves?
You should always do that. Alex strolled alongside, back in human form, though he still had a few flamingo feathers stuck in his hair. And you have to flaunt the weird, my friends.
I'm going to quote you on that, Percy said.
You'd better. We stopped at the corner, where Percy's Toyota Prius was parked at a meter. I shook his hand and got a big hug from Annabeth. My cousin gripped my shoulders. She studied my face, her gray eyes tight with concern.
Take care of yourself, Magnus. You will come back safely. That's an order.
Yes, ma'am, I promised. We chases have to stick together.
Speaking of that,
She lowered her voice.
Have you been over there yet?
I felt like I was in free fall again, swan diving toward a painful death. Not yet, I admitted. Today, I promise. The last I saw of Percy and Annabeth, their Prius was turning the corner on First Avenue. Percy singing along with Led Zeppelin on the radio, Annabeth laughing at his bad voice. Alex crossed his arms. If those two were any cuter together, they'd cause a nuclear explosion of cuteness and destroy the eastern seaboard. Is that your idea of a compliment? I asked. Probably as close as you'll ever hear. He glanced over. Where did you promise Annabeth you would go? My mouth tasted like I'd been chewing foil. My uncle's house. There's something I need to do.
Oh.
Alex nodded. I hate that place. I'd been avoiding this task for weeks. I didn't want to do it alone. I also didn't want to ask any of my other friends. Samira, Hearthstone, Blitzen, or the rest of the gang from floor 19 of the Hotel Valhalla. It felt too personal, too painful. But Alex had been to the Chase Mansion with me before. The idea of his company didn't bother me. In fact, I realized with surprise, I wanted him along pretty badly. I cleared the last falafel and seawater out of my throat. You want to come with me to a creepy mansion and look through a dead guy's stuff? Alex beamed. I thought you'd never ask. Chapter 3. I inherit a dead wolf and some underwear.
That's new, said Alex.
The brownstone's front door had been forced open. The deadbolt busted out of the frame. In the foyer, sprawled across the oriental rug, lay the carcass of a wolf. I shuddered. You couldn't swing a battle axe in the Nine Worlds without hitting some kind of wolf. Fenris wolf, Odin's wolves, Loki's wolves, werewolves, big bad wolves, and independently contracted small business wolves that would kill anybody for the right price. The dead wolf in Uncle Randolph's foyer looked very much like the beasts that had attacked my mom 2 years ago, the night she died. Wisps of blue luminescence clung to its shaggy black coat. Its mouth was contorted in a permanent snarl. On the top of its head, seared into the skin, was a Viking rune, though the fur around it was so badly burned I couldn't tell which symbol it was. My friend Hearthstone might have been able to say. Alex circled its pony-sized carcass. He kicked it in the ribs. The creature remained obligingly dead. Its body hasn't started to dissolve, he noted. Usually monsters disintegrate pretty soon after you kill them. You can still smell the burning fur on this one. Must have happened recently. You think the rune was some kind of trap? Alex smirked. I think your uncle knew a thing or two about magic. The wolf hit the carpet, triggering that rune, and bam! I remembered all the times when, as a homeless kid, I'd broken into Uncle Randolph's house when he wasn't there to steal food, rifle through his office, or just be annoying. I'd never been bammed. I'd always considered Randolph a failure at home security. Now I felt a little nauseous, wondering if I could have ended up dead on the welcome mat with a rune burned into my forehead. Was this trap the reason Randolph's will had been so specific about Annabeth and me visiting the property before we took possession? Had Randolph been trying to get some post-mortem revenge? You think the rest of the house is safe to explore? I asked. Nope, Alex said cheerfully. So let's do it. On the first floor, we found no more dead wolves. No runes exploded in our faces. The most gruesome thing we discovered was in Uncle Randolph's refrigerator, where expired yogurt, sour milk, and moldy carrots were evolving into a pre-industrial society. Randolph hadn't even left me any chocolate in the pantry. The old villain. On the second floor, nothing had changed. In Randolph's study, the sun streamed through the stained glass window, slanting red and orange light across the bookshelves and the displays of Viking artifacts. In one corner sat a big runestone carved with the sneering red face of, naturally, a wolf. Tattered maps and faded yellow parchments covered Randolph's desk. I scanned the documents, looking for something new, something important, but I saw nothing I hadn't seen the last time I'd been here. I remembered the wording of Randolph's will, which Annabeth had sent me. "It is critical," Randolph had stated, "that my beloved nephew Magnus examine my worldly belongings as soon as possible. He should pay special attention to my papers." I didn't know why Randolph had put those lines in his will. In his desk drawers, I found no letter addressed to me. No heartfelt apology like, "Dear Magnus, I'm sorry I got you killed, then betrayed you by siding with Loki, then stabbed your friend Blitzen, then almost got you killed again." He hadn't even left me the mansion's Wi-Fi password. I gazed out the office window. Across the street in the Commonwealth Mall, folks were walking their dogs, playing frisbee, enjoying the nice weather. The statue of Leif Erikson stood on his pedestal, proudly flaunting his metal bra, surveying the traffic on Charles Gate, and probably wondering why he wasn't in Scandinavia. "So," Alex came up next to me, "you inherit all of this, huh?" During our walk over, I'd told him the basics about Uncle Randolph's will. But Alex still looked incredulous, almost offended. "Randolph left the house to Annabeth and me," I said. "Technically, I'm dead. That means it's all Annabeth's." Randolph's lawyers contacted Annabeth's dad, who told her, who told me. Annabeth asked me to check it out, and I shrugged. "Decide what to do with this place." From the nearest bookshelf, Alex picked up a framed photo of Uncle Randolph with his wife and daughters. I'd never met Caroline, Emma, or Aubrey. They died in a firestorm at sea many years ago, but I'd seen them in my nightmares. I knew they were the leverage Loki had used to warp my uncle, promising Randolph that he could see his family again if he helped Loki escape his bonds. And in a way, Loki had told the truth. The last time I'd seen Uncle Randolph, he was tumbling into a chasm straight to Helheim, the land of the dishonorable dead. Alex turned over the photo, maybe hoping to find a secret note on the back. The last time we'd been in this office, we'd found a wedding invitation that way, and it had led us into all sorts of trouble. This time, there was no hidden message, just blank brown paper, which was a lot less painful to look at than the smiling faces of my dead relatives. Alex put the picture back on the shelf. "Annabeth doesn't care what you do with the house?" "Not really. She's got enough going on with college and, you know, demigod stuff. She just wants me to let her know if I find anything interesting. Old photo albums, family history, that kind of thing." Alex wrinkled his nose. "Family history." His face had the same slightly disgusted, slightly intrigued expression as when he'd kicked the dead wolf. "So what's upstairs?" "I'm not sure. When I was a kid, we weren't allowed above the first two floors. And the few times I broke in more recently, I turned up my palms. I guess I never made it that far." Alex peered at me over the top of his glasses, his dark brown eye and his amber eye like mismatched moons cresting on the horizon. "Sounds intriguing. Let's go." The third floor consisted of two large bedrooms. The front one was spotlessly clean, cold, and impersonal. Two twin beds, a dresser, bare walls, maybe a guest room, though I doubted Randolph entertained many people. Or maybe this had been Emma and Aubrey's room. If so, Randolph had removed all traces of their personalities, leaving a white void in the middle of the house. We didn't linger. The second bedroom must have been Randolph's. It smelled like his old-fashioned clove cologne. Towers of musty books leaned against the walls. Chocolate bar wrappers filled the wastebasket. Randolph had probably eaten his entire stash right before leaving home to help Loki destroy the world. I supposed I couldn't blame him. I always say, eat chocolate first, destroy the world later. Alex hopped onto the four-poster bed. He bounced up and down, grinning as the spring squeaked. "What are you doing?" I asked. "Making noise." He leaned over and rifled through Randolph's nightstand drawer. "Let's see. Cough drops, paper clips, some wadded-up Kleenex that I am not going to touch, and..." He whistled. "Medication for bowel discomfort. Magnus, all this bounty belongs to you. You're a strange person. I prefer the term fabulously weird." We searched the rest of the bedroom, though I wasn't sure what I was looking for. "Pay special attention to my papers," Randolph's Willett urged. I doubted he meant the wadded-up tissues. Annabeth hadn't been able to get much information out of Randolph's lawyers. Our uncle had apparently revised his will the day before he died. That might mean Randolph had known he didn't have long to live, felt some guilt about betraying me, and wanted to leave me some sort of last message. Or it might mean he'd revised the will because Loki had ordered him to. But if this was a trap to lure me here, then why was there a dead wolf in the foyer? I found no secret papers in Randolph's closet. His bathroom was unremarkable, except for an impressive collection of half-empty Listerine bottles. His underwear drawer was packed with enough navy blue jockeys to outfit a squadron of Randolphs. All briefs, perfectly starched, ironed, and folded. Some things defy explanation. On the next floor, two more empty bedrooms. Nothing dangerous like wolves, exploding runes, or old dude underwear. The top floor was a sprawling library, even larger than the one in Randolph's office. A haphazard collection of novels lined the shelves. A small kitchenette took up one corner of the room, complete with a mini-fridge and an electric teapot and, curse you, Randolph, still no chocolate. The windows looked out over the green shingled rooftops of Back Bay. At the far end of the room, a staircase led up to what I assumed would be a roof deck. A comfy-looking leather chair faced the fireplace. Carved in the center of the marble surround was, of course, a snarling wolf's head. On the mantel, in a silver tripod stand, sat a Norse drinking horn with a leather strap and a silver rim etched with runic designs. I'd seen thousands of horns like that in Valhalla, but it surprised me to find one here. Randolph had never struck me as the mead-swilling type. Maybe he sipped his Earl Grey tea out of it.
"Madre de Dios," Alex said.
I stared at him. It was the first time I'd ever heard him speak Spanish. He tapped one of the framed photos on the wall and gave me a wicked grin. "Please tell me this is you." The picture was a shot of my mother with her usual pixie haircut and brilliant smile, jeans, and flannel camping shirt. She stood in the hollowed-out trunk of a sycamore tree, holding a baby Magnus up to the camera, my hair a tuft of white gold, my mouth glistening with drool, my gray eyes wide like, "What the heck am I doing here?" "That's me," I admitted. "You were so cute." Alex glanced over. "What happened?" "Ha ha." I scanned the wall of photos. I was amazed Uncle Randolph had kept one of me and my mom right where he'd see it whenever he sat in his comfy chair, almost as if he actually cared about us. Another photo showed the three Chase siblings as children, Natalie, Frederick, and Randolph, all dressed in World War II military uniforms, brandishing fake rifles. Halloween, I guessed. Next to that was a picture of my grandparents, a frowning, white-haired couple, dressed in clashing 1970s-style plaid clothes, like they were either on their way to church or the senior citizens' disco. Confession. I had trouble telling my grandfather and grandmother apart. They died before I could meet them. But from their pictures, you could tell they were one of those couples that had grown to resemble each other over the years until they were virtually indistinguishable. Same white helmet hair, same glasses, same wispy mustaches. In the photo, a few Viking artifacts, including the mead horn that now sat on Randolph's mantle, hung on the wall behind them. I'd had no idea my grandparents were into Norse stuff, too. I wondered if they'd ever traveled the Nine Worlds. That might explain their confused, slightly cross-eyed expressions. Alex perused the titles on the bookshelves. "Anything good?" I asked. He shrugged. "The Lord of the Rings. Not bad. Sylvia Plath. Nice. Oh, The Left Hand of Darkness. I love that book. The rest? Meh." His collection is a little heavy on dead white males for my taste. "I'm a dead white male," I noted. Alex raised one eyebrow. "Yes, you are." I hadn't realized Alex was a reader. I was tempted to ask if he liked some of my favorites, Scott Pilgrim, or maybe Sandman. Those were fabulously weird. But I decided this might not be the right time to start a book club. I searched the shelves for diaries or hidden compartments. Alex meandered over to the last flight of stairs. He peered upward, and his complexion turned as green as his hair. Magnus? You should probably see this." I joined him. At the top of the staircase, a domed plexiglass hatch led to the roof. And on the other side, pacing and snarling, was another wolf. Chapter 4. But wait. Act now, and you get a second wolf free. "How do you want to handle this?" I asked. From his belt loops, Alex pulled the golden wire that served triple duty as fashion accessory, ceramic cutting tool, and melee weapon. "I was thinking we should kill it." The wolf growled and clawed at the hatch. Magical runes glowed on the plexiglass. The beast's facial fur was already smoking and charred from previous attempts to bust in. I wondered how long the wolf had been on the roof, and why it hadn't tried to gain access another way. Maybe it didn't want to end up dead like its friend downstairs. Or maybe it was single-mindedly focused on this particular room. "It wants something," I guessed. "To kill us," Alex said. "Which is why we should kill it first. You want to open the hatch, or..." "Wait." Normally, I would have been all in favor of killing a glowing blue wolf. But something about this animal bothered me. The way its cold, dark eyes seemed to be looking past us, as if searching for different prey. "What if we let it in?" Alex stared at me like I was crazy. He did that a lot. "You want to offer it a cup of tea? Maybe lend it a book?" "It has to be here on a mission," I persisted. "Somebody sent those wolves to retrieve something. Maybe the same something I'm looking for." Alex considered. "You think Loki sent the wolves?" I shrugged. "Loki's gonna Loki. And if we let the wolf in, you think it might make a beeline for whatever it's hunting. I'm pretty sure it isn't here for the irritable bowel medicine." Alex loosened his checkered tie even more. "Okay. We open the hatch, watch where the wolf goes, and then we kill it." "Right." I pulled the runestone pendant off my neck chain. Jack grew into sword form, though he felt heavier than usual, like a kid having a meltdown on the floor of a department store. "What is it now?" he sighed. "Can't you see I'm dying of a broken heart?" I could have pointed out that he was incapable of dying, and he had no actual heart, but I thought that would be mean. "Sorry, Jack, we have a wolf to deal with." I explained to him what was going on. Jack's blade glowed violet. "But Riptide's razor-sharp edges," he said dreamily. "Did you see her edges?"
"Yeah, great edges. Now how about we prevent Loki from launching his mighty death ship and starting Ragnarok? Then maybe we can arrange a second date for you and Riptide."
Another heavy sigh.
"Wolf, roof, hatch. Got it."
I glanced at Alex and stifled a shriek. While I wasn't looking, he'd transformed into a large timber wolf.
"Do you have to turn into animals behind my back?" I asked.
Alex bared his fangs in a canine grin. He snout pointed toward the top of the stairs like, "What are you waiting for? I'm a wolf. I can't open that hatch." I climbed to the top of the stairs. The temperature was like the inside of a greenhouse. On the other side of the hatch, the wolf snuffled and chewed at the plexiglass, leaving jewel smears and fang marks. Those protective barrier runes must have tasted great. Being this close to an enemy wolf made the hairs on the back of my neck do corkscrews. What would happen if I opened the hatch? Would the runes kill me? Would they kill the wolf? Or would they deactivate if I let the wolf in of my own free will, since that was literally the stupidest thing I could do? The wolf slavered at the plexiglass.
"Hey, buddy," I said.
Jack buzzed in my hand.
"What?"
"Not you, Jack. I'm talking to the wolf." I smiled at the beast, then remembered that showing teeth meant aggression to canines. I pouted instead.
"I'm going to let you in. Won't that be nice?
Then you can get whatever you came for, since I know you're not here to kill me, right?" The wolf's snarl was not reassuring.
"Okay then," I said. "One, two, three."
I pushed against the hatch with all my inherent strength, shoving the wolf back as I surged onto the roof deck. I had time to register a barbecue grill, some planters overflowing with hibiscus, and two lounge chairs overlooking an amazing view of the Charles River. I wanted to slap Uncle Randolph for never telling me he had such a cool party spot. The wolf stepped from behind the hatch and growled, its hackles raised like a shaggy dorsal fin. One of its eyes was swollen shut. The eyelid burned from contact with my uncle's rune trap.
"Now?"
Jack asked with no particular enthusiasm.
"Not yet."
I flexed my knees, ready to spring into action if necessary. I would show this wolf how well I could fight. Or, you know, how fast I could run away, depending on what the situation called for. The wolf regarded me with its one good eye. It snorted dismissively and bolted down the stairwell into the townhouse. I wasn't sure whether to be relieved or insulted. I ran after it. By the time I reached the bottom of the stairs, Alex and the other wolf were having a snarl off in the middle of the library. They bared their teeth and circled one another, looking for any signs of fear or weakness. The blue wolf was much larger. The neon wisps glowing in its fur gave it a certain cool factor. But it was also half-blind and wincing in pain. Alex, being Alex, showed no sign of being intimidated. He stood his ground as the other wolf edged around him. Once our glowing blue visitor was confident Alex wasn't going to attack, it raised its snout and sniffed the air. I expected it to run toward the bookshelves and chomp some secret book of nautical maps, or maybe a copy of How to Stop Loki's Ship of Death in 3 Easy Steps. Instead, the wolf lunged toward the fireplace, jumped at the mantle, and grabbed the mead horn in its mouth. Some sluggish part of my brain thought, "Hey, I should probably stop it." Alex was way ahead of me. In one fluid movement, he morphed back into human form, stepped forward, and lashed out with his garrote like he was throwing a bowling ball. Actually, it was a lot more graceful than that. I'd seen Alex bowl, and it wasn't pretty. The golden cord wrapped around the wolf's neck. With one yank backward, Alex cured the wolf of any future headache problems. The decapitated carcass flopped against the carpet. It began to sizzle, disintegrating until only the drinking horn and a few tufts of fur remained. Jack's blade turned heavier in my grip. "Well, fine," he said. "I guess you didn't need me after all. I'll just go write some love poetry and cry a lot." He shrank back into a runestone pendant. Alex crouched next to the mead horn. "Any idea why a wolf would want a decorative drinking vessel?" I knelt next to him, picked up the horn, and looked inside. Rolled up and crammed into the horn was a small leather book, like a diary. I pulled it out and fanned the pages. Drawings of Viking runes, interspersed with paragraphs written in Uncle Randolph's cramped cursive. "I think," I said, "we found the right dead white male author." We reclined in the lounge chairs on the roof deck. While I flipped through my uncle's notebook, trying to make sense of his frenzied rune drawings and cursive crazy talk, Alex relaxed and sipped guava juice from the mead horn. Why Uncle Randolph kept guava juice in his library's mini-fridge, I couldn't tell you. Every so often, just to annoy me, Alex slurped with exaggerated gusto and smacked his lips. "Are you sure it's safe to drink from that horn?" I asked. "It could be cursed or something." Alex grabbed his throat and pretended to choke. "Oh no, I'm turning into a frog!" "Please don't." He pointed at the diary. "Any luck with that?" I stared at the pages. Runes swam in front of my eyes. The notations were in a mix of languages. Old Norse, Swedish, and some I couldn't begin to guess. Even the passages in English made little sense. I felt like I was trying to read an advanced quantum physics textbook backward in a mirror. "Most of it's over my head," I admitted. "The earlier pages look like they're about Randolph's search for the Sword of Summer. I recognize some of the references. But here at the end..." The last few pages were more hastily written. Randolph's writing turned shaky and frantic. Splotches of dried blood freckled the paper. I remembered that, in the tomb of the Viking zombies in Provincetown, Randolph had gotten several of his fingers lopped off. These pages might have been written after that, with his non-dominant hand. The watery cursive reminded me of the way I used to write back in elementary school, when my teacher forced me to use my right hand. On the last page, Randolph had scratched my name. Magnus. Under that, he'd sketched two serpents interlocking in a figure eight. The quality of the drawing was terrible, but I recognized the symbol. Alex had the same thing tattooed on the nape of his neck. The sign of Loki. Below that was a term in what I assumed was Old Norse. Mi-yoth. Then some notes in English. Might stop L. Whetstone of Bulwark. Greater than guards. Where? That last word trailed downward, the question mark a desperate scrawl. "What do you make of this?" I passed the book to Alex. He frowned. "That's my mom's symbol, obviously." "You heard right. Loki was normally a male god, but he happened to be Alex's mother. Long story." "And the rest of it?" I asked. "This word looks like moo with a J. Perhaps Scandinavian cows have an accent?" "I take it you don't read Old Norse then, or whatever that language is?" "Magnus, it may shock you to learn that I do not have every talent in the world. Just most of the important ones." He squinted at the page. When he concentrated, the left corner of his mouth twitched, like he was enjoying a secret joke. I found that tick distracting. I wanted to know what he found so funny. "Might stop L," Alex read. "Let's assume that's Loki. Whetstone of Bulwark. You think that's the same thing as the Skulfnung stone?" I shuddered. We'd lost the Skulfnung stone and Skulfnung sword during a wedding party in Loki's cavern, when he'd escaped the bindings that had held him for 1,000 years. Oops, our bad. I never wanted to see that particular whetstone again. "I hope not," I said. "Ever heard the name Bulwark?" "Nope." Alex finished his guava juice. "I'm kind of digging this mead horn, though. You mind if I keep it?" "All yours." I found the idea of Alex taking a souvenir from my family mansion strangely pleasing. "So if Randolph wanted me to find that book, and Loki sent the wolves to get it before I could..." Alex tossed the journal back to me. "Assuming what you just said is true, and assuming it's not a trap, and assuming those notes aren't the ramblings of a madman?" Yeah. "Then best case scenario, your uncle came up with an idea to stop Loki. It wasn't something he could do himself, but he hoped you could. It involves a whetstone, a bulwark, and possibly a Scandinavian cow. When you put it like that, it doesn't sound so promising." Alex poked the tip of the mead horn. "Sorry to burst your bubble, but most plans to stop Loki fail. We know this." The bitter edge in his voice surprised me. "You're thinking about your training sessions with Sam," I guessed. "How are they going?" Alex's face told me the answer. Among Loki's many disturbing qualities, he could command his children to do whatever he wanted whenever they were in his presence, which made family reunions a real drag. Alex was the exception. He'd somehow learned to resist Loki's power, and for the past 6 weeks, he'd been trying to teach his half-sister Samira al-Abbas to do the same. The fact that neither of them talked much about their training suggested that it hadn't been a rousing success. "She's trying," Alex said. "It doesn't make it easier that she's..." He stopped himself. "What?" "Never mind. I promise not to talk about it." "Now I'm really curious. Is everything okay with her and Amir?" Alex snorted. "Oh yeah. They're still head over heels, dreaming of the day when they can get married. I swear, if those two didn't have me to chaperone them, they'd do something crazy like hold hands." "Then what's the problem?" Alex waved off my question. "All I'm saying is that you shouldn't trust anything you get from your Uncle Randolph. Not the advice in that book. Not this house. Anything you inherit from family. It always comes with strings attached." That seemed a strange thing for him to say, considering he'd been enjoying the view from Randolph's magnificent roof deck while sipping chilled guava juice from his Viking mead horn. But I got the feeling Alex wasn't really thinking about my dysfunctional uncle. "You never talk much about your family," I noted. "I mean your mortal family." He stared at me darkly. "And I'm not going to start now. If you knew half the Brock," in a flutter of black feathers, a raven landed on the tip of Alex's boot. You don't see a lot of wild ravens in Boston. Canadian geese, seagulls, ducks, pigeons, even hawks, sure. But when a huge black raptor lands on your foot, that can only mean one thing. A message from Valhalla. Alex held out his hand. Not normally recommended with ravens. They have a vicious bite. The bird hopped on his wrist, barfed up a hard pellet the size of a pecan right into Alex's palm, and then flew away. Its mission accomplished. "Yes, our ravens deliver messages via barf mail." Ravens have a natural ability to regurgitate inedible substances like bones and fur, so they have no qualms about swallowing a message capsule, flying it across the nine worlds, and vomiting it to the correct recipient. It wouldn't have been my chosen career, but hey, no judgment. Alex cracked open the pellet. He unfolded the letter and began to read, the corner of his mouth starting to twitch again. "It's from TJ," he said. "Looks like we're leaving today. Right now, in fact." "What?" I sat up in my recliner. "Why?" Of course, I'd known we were running out of time. We had to leave soon in order to reach Loki's ship before midsummer. But there was a big difference between soon and right now. I wasn't a big fan of right now. Alex kept reading. "Something about the tide? I don't know. I'd better go bust Samira out of school. She'll be in calculus. She's not going to be happy about leaving." He rose and offered me a hand. I didn't want to get up. I wanted to stay there on that deck with Alex and watch the afternoon sunlight change the color of the river from blue to amber. Maybe we could read some of Randolph's old paperbacks. We could drink all his guava juice. But the Raven had barfed up our orders. You couldn't argue with Raven barf. I took Alex's hand and got to my feet. "You want me to come with you?" Alex frowned. "No, dummy. You've got to get back to Valhalla. You're the one with the boat. Speaking of which, have you warned the others about..." "No," I said, my face burning. "Not yet." Alex laughed. "That should be interesting. Don't wait for Sam and me. We'll catch up with you somewhere along the way." Before I could ask what he meant by that, Alex turned into a flamingo and launched himself into the sky, making it a banner day for Boston bird watchers. Chapter 5. I bid farewell to Eric, and also Eric. Legends tell us that Valhalla has 540 doors, conveniently distributed across the nine worlds for easy access. The legends don't mention that one of those entrances is in the Forever 21 store on Newberry Street, just behind the women's activewear rack. It normally wasn't the entrance I liked to use, but it was the closest to Uncle Randolph's mansion. Nobody in Valhalla could explain to me why we had a gateway in Forever 21. Some speculated it was left over from a time when the building was not a retail store. Personally, I thought the location might be one of Odin's little jokes, since a lot of his Inherjar were literally Forever 21, or 16, or 60. My dwarf friend Blitzen especially hated that entrance. Every time I mentioned Forever 21, he would launch into a rant about how his fashions were much better. Something about hemlines. I don't know. I strolled through the lingerie section, getting a strange look from a sales lady, then dove into the activewear rack and popped out the other side in one of the Hotel Valhalla's game rooms. There was a pool tournament in progress, which Vikings play with spears instead of pool cues. Hint, never stand behind a Viking when he shoots. Eric the Green from floor 135 greeted me cheerfully. From what I can tell, approximately 72% of the population of Valhalla is named Eric. "Hail, Magnus Chase!" he pointed at my shoulder. "You've got some spandex just there." "Oh, thanks." I untangled the yoga pants that had gotten stuck on my shirt and tossed them into the bin marked for restocking. Then I strode off to find my friends. Walking through the Hotel Valhalla never got old. At least it hadn't for me so far. And Inherjar, who'd been here for hundreds of years, had told me the same thing. Thanks to the power of Odin, or the magic of the Norns, or maybe just the fact that we had an on-site IKEA, the decor was constantly changing, though it always incorporated a lot of spears and shields, and perhaps more wolf motifs than I would have liked. Even just finding the elevators required me to navigate hallways that had changed size and direction since the morning, past rooms I'd never seen before. In one enormous oak-paneled lounge, warriors played shuffleboard with oars for pushers and combat shields for pucks. Many of the players sported leg splints, arm slings, and head bandages because, of course, Enheriar played shuffleboard to the death. The main lobby had been recarpeted in deep crimson, a great color to hide bloodstains. The walls were now hung with tapestries depicting Valkyries flying into battle against fire giants. It was beautiful work, though the proximity of so many wall torches made me nervous. Valhalla was pretty lax about safety codes. I didn't like burning to death. It was one of my least favorite ways to die, right up there with choking on the after-dinner mints in the feast hall. I took the elevator up to floor 19. Unfortunately, the elevator music hadn't changed. It was getting to the point that I could sing along with Frank Sinatra in Norwegian. I was just glad I lived on a low floor. If I lived somewhere up in the hundreds, I would have gone, well, berserk. On floor 19, everything was strangely quiet. No sounds of video game violence emanated from Thomas Jefferson Jr.'s room. Dead Civil War soldiers love their video games almost as much as they love charging up hills. I saw no signs that Mallory Keene had been practicing her knife throwing in the hallway. Half-born Gunderson's room was open and being serviced by a flock of ravens who swirled through his library and his weapons collection, dusting books and battle axes. The big man himself was nowhere to be seen. My own room had recently been cleaned. The bed was made. In the central atrium, the trees had been pruned and the grass mowed. I could never figure out how the ravens operated a lawnmower. On the coffee table, a note in TJ's elegant script read, "We're at Dock 23, sub-level 6. See you there." The TV had been turned to the Hotel Valhalla channel, which displayed a list of the afternoon's events. Racquetball, machine gun tag, like laser tag, except with machine guns, watercolor painting, Italian cooking, advanced sword sharpening, and something called flighting, all done to the death. I stared wistfully at the screen. I'd never wanted to practice watercolor painting to the death before, but now I was tempted. It sounded much easier than the trip I was about to take from Dock 23, sub-level 6. First things first, I showered off the smell of Boston Harbor. I changed into new clothes. I grabbed my go bag, camping supplies, some basic provisions, and of course, some chocolate bars. As nice as my hotel suite was, I didn't have much in the way of personal stuff. Just a few of my favorite books, and some photos from my past that magically appeared over time, gradually filling up the fireplace mantle. The hotel wasn't meant to be a forever home. We and Herjar might stay here for centuries, but it was only a stopover on our way to Ragnarok. The whole hotel radiated a sense of impermanence and anticipation. "Don't get too comfortable," it seemed to say. "You might be leaving any minute to go die your final death at Doomsday. Hooray!" I checked my reflection in the full-length mirror. I wasn't sure why it mattered. I'd never cared much about appearances during the 2 years I'd lived on the streets, but lately Alex Fierro had been teasing me mercilessly, which made me more conscious of how I looked. Besides, if you don't check yourself from time to time in Valhalla, you could be walking around for hours with raven poop on your shoulder, or an arrow in your butt, or a pair of yoga pants wrapped around your neck. Hiking boots? Check. New pair of jeans? Check. Green Hotel Valhalla t-shirt? Check. Down jacket, appropriate for cold water expeditions and falling off masts? Check. Runestone pendant that could turn into a heartbroken magical sword? Check. After living on the streets, I wasn't used to my face looking so clean. I definitely wasn't used to my new haircut, which Blitz had first given me during our expedition into Jotunheim. Since then, every time it started to grow out, Alex hacked it off again, leaving my bangs just long enough to fall in my eyes, the back chopped to collar level. I was used to my hair being much wilder and more wiry, but Alex took such glee in murdering my blonde locks, it was impossible to tell him no. "It's perfect," Alex said. "Now you at least look like you're groomed, but your face is still obscured." I slipped Randolph's notebook into my pack, along with one last item I'd been trying hard not to think about, a certain silk handkerchief I'd gotten from my father. I sighed at the Magnus in the mirror. "Well, sir, you'd better get going. Your friends are eagerly waiting to laugh at you."
"There he is!"
yelled Halfborn Gunderson, berserker extraordinaire, speaker of the obvious. He barreled toward me like a friendly Mack truck. His hair was even wilder than mine used to be. I was pretty sure he cut it himself, using a battle axe, in the dark. He wore a t-shirt today, which was unusual, but his arms were still a wild landscape of muscle and tattoo. Strapped across his back was his battle axe, named Battle Axe, and holstered up and down his leather breeches were half a dozen knives. He wrapped me in a bear hug and lifted me off my feet, perhaps testing to make sure my ribcage would not crack under pressure. He put me down and patted my arms, apparently satisfied.
"You ready for a quest?" he bellowed. "I'm ready for a quest!"
From the edge of the canal, where she was coiling ropes, Mallory Keene called,
"Oh, shut up, you oaf! I still think we should use you as the rudder!"
Halfborn's face mottled red, but he kept his eyes on me.
"I'm trying not to kill her, Magnus. I really am. But it's so hard. I'd better keep busy, or I'm going to do something I'll regret. You have the handkerchief?"
Yes, but...
"Good man! Time's a-wasting!"
He tromped back to the dockside and began sorting his supplies. Huge canvas duffels, no doubt full of food, weapons, and lots of spare leather breeches. I scanned the length of the cavern. Along the left-hand wall, a river rushed through the canal, emerging from a train-sized tunnel on one end and disappearing into an identical tunnel on the other. The barreled ceiling was polished wood, amplifying the water's roar and making me feel like we were standing inside an old-fashioned root beer keg. Supplies and baggage lined the dock, just waiting for a ship to be put on. At the far end of the room, Thomas Jefferson Jr. stood deep in conversation with the hotel manager, Helgi, and his assistant, Hunding, all three of them looking over some paperwork on a clipboard. Since I had an aversion to paperwork, and also to Helgi, I walked over to Mallory, who was now stuffing iron grappling hooks into a burlap sack. She was dressed in black furs and black denim, her red hair pulled back in a severe bun. In the torchlight, her freckles glowed orange. As usual, she wore her trusty pair of knives at her sides. "Everything good?" I asked, because clearly it wasn't. She scowled.
"Don't you start too, mister."
She called me a Gaelic term I didn't recognize, but I was fairly sure it didn't mean dearest friend.
"We've been waiting on you in the boat."
"Where are Blitzen and Hearthstone?" It had been several weeks since I'd seen my dwarf and elf buddies, and I'd been looking forward to them sailing with us. One of the few things I was looking forward to. Mallory grunted impatiently.
"We're picking them up on the way."
That could have meant we were stopping by a different part of Boston, or stopping by a different world, but Mallory didn't look like she was in the mood to elaborate. She scanned the space behind me and scowled.
"What about Alex and Samira?"
"Alex said they'd meet us later."
"Well then,"
Mallory made a shooing gesture,
"go sign us out."
"Sign us out?"
"Yeah."
She drawled the word to indicate just how slow she thought I was.
"With Helgi, the manager. Off you go."
Since she was still holding a fistful of grappling hooks, I did what she told me. TJ had his foot planted on a supply box, his rifle across his back. The brass buttons gleamed on his Union Army coat. He tipped his infantry cap at me in greeting.
Just in time, my friend!
Helgi and Hunding exchanged nervous looks, the way they did whenever Odin announced one of his motivational staff retreats.
Magnus Chase,
Helgi said, tugging at his roadkill beard. He was dressed in his usual dark green pinstripe suit, which he probably thought made him look like a service industry professional, but only made him look like a Viking in a pinstripe suit.
We were beginning to worry. The high tide will be here any minute.
I looked at the water raging down the canal. I knew that several subterranean rivers wove their way through Valhalla, but I didn't understand how they could be subject to tides. I also didn't see how the water level here could get any higher without flooding the entire room. Then again, I was having a conversation with two dead Vikings and a Civil War soldier, so I decided to give logic a rest. Sorry, I said. I waved vaguely, trying to indicate reading mysterious journals, killing wolves, breaking my leg in Boston Harbor. TJ practically vibrated with excitement.
You got the boat? I can't wait to see it!
Yeah. I started rummaging in my knapsack, but the handkerchief seemed to have fallen to the bottom. Hunding wrung his hands. His bellhop uniform was buttoned wrong, like he'd rushed to get dressed this morning.
You didn't lose it, did you?
Oh, I warned you about leaving unattended magic items in your room. I told the cleaning ravens not to touch it. It's a warship, I said, not a napkin. But they kept wanting to launder it with the linens. If it's missing, then you'll be held responsible. Helgi snarled at the bellhop.
Floor 19 is your service area.
Hunding winced. He and Helgi had a feud that went back several centuries. The manager welcomed any excuse to make Hunding work extra shifts shoveling garbage into the incinerators or hosing out the lindworm warrens. Relax, I pulled out the piece of cloth. See, here it is. And Hunding, this is for you. I handed him one of my chocolate bars. Thanks for keeping an eye on my room while I'm gone. The bellhop's eyes turned misty.
Kid, you're the best. You can leave unattended magic items in your room anytime.
Humph.
Helgi scowled.
Well then, Magnus Chase, I'll need you to sign out.
He thrust the clipboard at me.
Read carefully and initial at the bottom of each page.
I flipped through a dozen pages of dense contract language. I skimmed over phrases like, in the event of death by squirrel attack, and the proprietor shall not be held liable for off-site dismemberment. No wonder my friends preferred to leave the hotel without permission. The release forms were brutal. TJ cleared his throat.
So, Magnus, maybe while you're doing that, I could set up the boat? Can I? I'm ready to get this regiment underway.
I could tell. He was loaded down with enough ammunition pouches, haversacks, and canteens for a 30-day march. His eyes gleamed as brightly as his bayonet. Since TJ was usually the voice of reason on Floor 19, I was glad to have him along, even if he did get a little too excited about full frontal charges on enemy positions.
Yeah, I said. Sure, man. Yay!
He plucked the handkerchief out of my hand and hustled toward the dock. I signed the release forms, trying not to get hung up on the clauses about arbitration in case we got incinerated in the fires of Muspelheim or got pulverized by frost giants. I handed the clipboard back to Helgi. The manager frowned.
You sure you read everything?
Yeah. I'm a fast reader. Helgi gripped my shoulder.
Then good luck, Magnus Chase, son of Frey. And remember, you must stop Loki's ship, Naglfar, from sailing at midsummer.
I know.
Or Ragnarok begins.
Right.
Which means our renovations to the banquet hall won't ever be complete, and we'll never get high-speed internet restored on floor 242.
I nodded grimly.
I did not need the extra pressure of being responsible for an entire floor's internet connection. We'll succeed. Don't worry. Helgi tugged at his beard.
But if you do start Ragnarok, could you please get back here as soon as possible? Or send us a text?
Okay. A text? As far as I knew, the hotel staff just used Ravens. They didn't know how to use mobile devices. None of them even had numbers. But that didn't stop them from talking a good game.
We'll need to get everyone started on their checkout surveys before we march off to Doomsday, Helgi explained, to expedite their deaths. If you can't make it back, you can also fill out your survey online. And if you wouldn't mind marking excellent wherever it mentions the manager, I'd appreciate it. Odin does read those.
But if we're all going to die anyway...
Good man!
He patted my shoulder.
Well, have a safe, successful journey.
He tucked the clipboard under his arm and strolled off, probably going to inspect those renovations to the banquet hall. Hunding sighed.
That man has no sense.
Thanks for the chocolate, though, my boy. I just wish there was something more I could do for you. My scalp tingled with inspiration. During my time at the hotel, Hunding had become my best source of information. He knew where all the bodies were buried, literally. He knew all the secret room service menu items, and how you could get from the lobby to the observation deck above the Grove of Glacier without having to pass through the gauntlet of gift shops. He was a walking Vikingpedia. I pulled out Randolph's journal and showed him the last page. Any idea what this word means? I pointed to Mioth. Hunding laughed.
It says mead, of course.
Huh. So it has nothing to do with cows.
Pardon?
Never mind. What about this name here? Bolverk. Hunding flinched so violently, he dropped his chocolate bar.
Bolverk? No!
No, no, no. What is this book, anyway? Why would you possibly...
Arg!
Halfborn yelled from dockside.
Magnus, we need you over here now!
The river was starting to surge, frothing and lapping over the edge of the canal. TJ shook the handkerchief desperately, yelling,
How does it work? How does it work?
It hadn't occurred to me that the foldable ship, being a gift from my dad, might only work for me. I ran over to help. Mallory and Halfborn were scrambling to gather their supplies.
We've got a minute at most before the high tide comes flooding through here, yelled Halfborn. Ship, Magnus! Now!
I took the handkerchief and tried to steady my shaking hands. I'd practiced this ship-unfolding trick a couple of times on calmer water, once by myself and once with Alex, but I could still hardly believe it would work. I definitely wasn't looking forward to the results. I flicked the handkerchief toward the water. As soon as the cloth hit the surface, the corners unfolded and unfolded and kept unfolding. It was like watching the building of a Lego model in a sped-up stop-motion video. In the space of two breaths, a Viking longship lay at anchor in the canal, the turbulent water coursing around its stern. But of course, nobody complimented me on its beautifully trimmed hull, or the elaborate Viking shields lining the rails, or the five rows of oars ready for service. No one noted how the mainmast was hinged and folded over so it could pass through this low tunnel without breaking apart. No one gasped at the beauty of the carved dragon figurehead, or praised the fact that the ship was much larger and more spacious than your typical longship, even boasting a covered area below decks so we wouldn't have to sleep in the rain and snow. Mallory Keene's first comment was,
Can we talk about the color?
TJ frowned.
Why is it? I don't know, I wailed. I don't know why it's yellow.
My father, Frey, had sent me the boat weeks ago, promising that it was the perfect vessel to use on our voyage. It would get us where we needed to go.
It would protect us on the most treacherous seas. My friends had been excited. They had trusted me, even when I'd refused to give them a preview of our magical ship. But why, oh why, had my father made the boat the color of I can't believe it's not butter? Everything about it was neon, eye-melting yellow. The ropes, the shields, the hull, the sail, the rudder, even the dragon figurehead. For all I knew, the bottom of the keel was yellow too, and we'd blind every fish we sailed past.
Well, it doesn't matter now,
Halfborn said, scowling at me like it mattered very much.
Load up! Hurry!
A roar echoed from the upstream tunnel like an approaching freight train. The ship banged against the dock. Halfborn tossed our supplies on deck as TJ held up the anchor, while Mallory and I held the mooring lines fast with all our inherent strength. Just as Halfborn threw the last sacks, a wall of water burst out of the tunnel behind us.
Let's go! Yelled TJ.
We jumped aboard as the wave slammed into our stern, propelling us forward like the kick of a 70-million-gallon mule. I glanced back at the dock one last time. Hounding the bellhop stood knee-deep in water, clutching his chocolate bar, staring at me as we rocketed into the darkness, his face bleached with shock as if, after all these centuries of dealing with the dead in Valhalla, he'd finally seen an actual ghost. Chapter 6. I have a nightmare about toenails. I like my rivers the way I like my enemies. Slow, wide, and lazy. I rarely get what I like. Our boat shot down the rapids in near total darkness. My friends scrambled around the deck, grabbing ropes and tripping over oars. The ship rocked side to side, making me feel like I was surfing on a pendulum. Mallory hugged the rudder with her full weight, trying to keep us in the middle of the current.
Don't just stand there, she yelled at me. Help!
The old saying is true. No nautical training survives first contact with the water. I'm pretty sure that's an old saying. Everything I'd learned from Percy Jackson evaporated out of my brain. I forgot starboard and port, stern and aft. I forgot how to discourage shark attacks and how to fall off a mast properly. I hopped across the deck yelling, "I'm helping! I'm helping!" without knowing what to do at all. We swerved and sloshed through the tunnel at impossible speeds, our retracted mast barely clearing the roof. The tips of our oars scraped against the stone walls, leaving trails of bright yellow sparks that made it look like fairies were ice skating alongside us. TJ rushed past me, heading for the prow, and nearly impaled me with his bayonet.
Magnus, hold that line!
He yelled, waving at pretty much every rope on the ship. I grabbed the nearest bit of rigging and pulled as hard as I could, hoping I had the right line, or hoping I at least looked helpful while doing the wrong thing. We bumped down a series of cataracts. My teeth clattered out telegraph messages. Frigid waves crashed over the shields on the railing. Then the tunnel widened and we sideswiped a rock that came out of nowhere. The boat spun a 360. We dropped down a waterfall towards certain death, and as the air turned to cold, misty soup around us, everything went dark. What a fantastic time to have a vision! I found myself standing on the deck of a different ship. In the distance, glacial cliffs rimmed a vast bay marbled with ice. The air was so cold, a layer of frost crackled over my coat sleeves. Beneath my feet, instead of wooden planking, spread a bumpy surface of glistening gray and black, like the shell of an armadillo. The entire ship, a Viking vessel the size of an aircraft carrier, was made of the same stuff, and unfortunately I knew what it was. The clipped toenails and fingernails of the dishonored dead. Billions upon billions of nasty zombie cuttings, all cobbled together by evil pedicurist magic to create Naglfar, the Ship of Nails, also known as the Ship of the Dead. Above me, Gray sails rippled in the freezing wind. Shuffling across the deck were thousands of desiccated human husks dressed in rusted armor. Draugr, Viking zombies. Giants strode among them, shouting orders and kicking them to form ranks. Out of the corners of my eyes, I caught glimpses of darker things, too. Incorporeal shades that might have been wolves or serpents or skeletal horses made of smoke.
"Look who's here," said a cheerful voice.
Standing before me, in the white uniform of a Navy admiral, was Loki himself. His autumn leaf-colored hair swept around the edges of his flag officer's hat. His intense irises glinted like rings of hardening amber, suffocating the life out of his poor trapped pupils. Despite the pitted wreckage of his face, damaged from centuries of snake venom dripping between his eyes, despite the scarred and twisted lips that had once been sewn together by an angry dwarf, Loki grinned in such a warm, friendly way, it was almost impossible not to smile back.
"Coming to visit me?" he asked. "Awesome!"
I tried to yell at him. I wanted to berate him for getting my uncle killed, for torturing my friends, for ruining my life and causing me 6 solid months of indigestion. But my throat was filled with wet cement.
"Nothing to say?"
Loki chuckled.
"That's all right, because I've got plenty to tell you. First, a friendly warning. I'd really think twice about following old Randolph's plan."
His expression tightened with false sympathy.
"I'm afraid the poor man got a little senile there toward the end. You'd have to be crazy to listen to him."
I wanted to strangle Loki, but my hands felt strangely heavy. I looked down and saw that my fingernails were growing at unnatural speed, stretching toward the deck like taproots seeking soil. My feet felt too tight in my shoes. Somehow I knew that my toenails were also lengthening, pushing through my socks, trying to escape the confines of my hiking boots.
"What else?"
Loki tapped his chin.
"Oh yes! Look!"
He gestured past the hordes of shuffling zombies, sweeping his arm across the bay as if revealing a fabulous prize I'd just won. On the misty horizon, one of the glacial cliffs had begun to calve, sheeting massive curtains of ice into the water. The sound hit me half a second later, a muffled rumble like thunder through thick clouds.
"Cool, huh?"
Loki grinned.
"The ice is melting much faster than I thought. I love global warming. We'll be able to sail before the week is out. So really, you're already too late. I'd turn around and go back to Valhalla if I were you. You've only got a few days to enjoy yourself before Ragnarok hits. Might as well take some of those fabulous yoga classes."
My rebellious fingernails reached the deck. They wove their way into the glistening gray surface, pulling me down, forcing me to double over. My toenails burst through the tips of my boots. They rooted me in place while dead men's nails began to grow upward like saplings, curling eagerly around my shoelaces, vining their way up my ankles. Loki looked down at me with a gentle smile, as if watching a toddler take his first steps.
"Yes, it's a wonderful week for Doomsday. But if you do insist on challenging me..."
He sighed and shook his head like, "You crazy kids and your quests."
"Then please leave my children out of it, will you? Poor Sam and Alex. They've suffered enough. If you care for them at all, well, this quest will destroy them. I promise you that. They have no idea what they'll be facing."
I fell to my knees. I could no longer tell where my own fingernails and toenails stopped and the ship began. jagged branches of gray and black keratin tightened around my calves and wrists, chaining me to the deck, encircling my limbs, pulling me down into the fabric of the ship itself.
"Take care, Magnus," Loki called. "One way or another, we'll talk again soon."
A rough hand clamped my shoulder, shaking me awake.
"Magnus!" yelled Halfborn Gunderson. "Snap out of it, man! Grab an oar!"
I found myself back on the deck of our bright yellow ship. We were drifting sideways through a cold, dense fog, the current pulling us to port, where the river fell away into roaring darkness. I swallowed the wet cement clogging my throat. "Is that another waterfall?" Mallory dropped on the bench next to me.
"One that'll send us straight into Geenengagap and kill us, yeah. You feel like rowing now?"
TJ and Halfborn took the bench in front of us. Together, we four rowed with all our strength, turning starboard and dragging our ship away from the precipice. My shoulders burned. My back muscles screamed in protest. Finally, the roaring sound faded behind us. The fog burned away, and I saw that we were in Boston Harbor, not far from Old Ironsides. Rising on my left were the brick row houses and church steeples of Charlestown. TJ turned and grinned.
"See? That wasn't so bad."
"Sure," Mallory said. "Except for almost falling off the edge of the world and being vaporized."
Halfborn stretched his arms.
"I feel like I've just carried an elephant up Bunker Hill. But good job, all."
He faltered when he saw my face.
"Magnus, what is it?"
I stared at my trembling hands. I felt as if my fingernails were still growing, trying to find their way back to the ship of the dead. "I had a little vision," I muttered. "Give me a sec." My friends exchanged wary looks. They all knew there was no such thing as a little vision. Mallory Keene scooted closer to me.
"Gunderson, why don't you take the rudder?"
Halfborn frowned.
"I don't take orders from—"
Mallory glared at him. Halfborn muttered under his breath and went to take the rudder. Mallory fixed me with her eyes, the green irises flecked with brown and orange like the shells of cardinal's eggs.
"Was it Loki you saw?"
Normally, I didn't get this close to Mallory unless she was pulling an axe out of my chest on the battlefield. She valued her personal space. There was something troubling about her gaze, a sort of free-floating anger, like a fire that jumped from rooftop to rooftop. You never knew what it would burn and what it would leave alone.
"Yeah,"
I explained what I'd seen. Mallory's lip curled with disgust.
"That trickster. We've all been seeing him in our nightmares lately. When I get my hands on him—"
"Hey, Mallory," TJ chided. "I know you want revenge even more than most of us, but—" Keen stopped him with a harsh look. I wondered what TJ was talking about. I'd heard that Mallory had died trying to disarm a car bomb in Ireland, but beyond that, I knew very little of her past. Had Loki been responsible for her death? She gripped my wrist, her calloused fingers reminding me uncomfortably of the keratin vines of Naglfar.
"Magnus, Loki's calling you out. If you have that dream again, don't talk to him. Don't be baited."
"Baited into what?" I asked. Behind us, Halfborn yelled,
"Valkyrie at 10 o'clock!
He pointed to the Charlestown waterfront. About a quarter mile ahead, I could just make out two figures standing on the dock, one with a green hijab, the other with green hair. Mallory scowled at Gunderson.
"Do you have to be so loud, you oaf?
This is my regular voice, woman!"
"Yes, I know. Loud and annoying.
If you don't like it—"
"Magnus," she said, "we'll talk later."
She stomped over to the deck hatch, where Halfborn had dropped his battle axe during all the confusion. She scooped up the weapon and brandished it at Halfborn.
"You can have this back when you start to behave."
She slid down the ladder and disappeared below decks.
Oh, no, she didn't.
Halfborn abandoned his post and marched after her. The ship began to list to starboard. TJ scrambled back and took the rudder. He sighed. Those two picked a terrible time to break up. Wait, what? I asked. TJ raised his eyebrows. You didn't hear? Halfborn and Mallory argued so much, it was hard to tell when they were angry and when they were just showing affection. Now that I thought about it, though, they had been a little more aggressive with each other the last few days. Why the breakup? TJ shrugged. The afterlife is a marathon, not a sprint. Long-term relationships are tricky when you live forever. It's not uncommon for inherited couples to break up 60, 70 times over the course of a few centuries. I tried to imagine that. Of course, I'd never been in a relationship, long-term or otherwise, so I couldn't. And we're stuck on a ship with them, I noted. While they're working out their differences, surrounded by a wide assortment of weapons. They're both professionals, said TJ. I'm sure it'll be fine.
Thunk!
Below my feet, the deck shuddered with the sound of an axe impaling wood. Right, I said. And the stuff Mallory was saying about Loki? TJ's smile melted. We all have our problems with that trickster. I wondered what TJ's were. I'd lived with my friends on Floor 19 for months now, but I was starting to realize how little I knew about their pasts. Thomas Jefferson Jr., former infantryman in the 54th Massachusetts, son of the war god Tyr and a freed slave. TJ never seemed to get flustered, even when he got killed on the battlefield, or when he had to intercept Halfborn Gunderson sleepwalking naked through the halls and get him back to his room. TJ had the sunniest disposition of any dead person I knew. But he must have seen his share of horrors. I wondered what sort of ammunition Loki used to taunt him in his dreams. Mallory said Loki was calling me out, I remembered. And that I shouldn't take the bait? TJ flexed his fingers, as if he were having sympathetic pains from his father Tyr, who'd gotten his hand bitten off by Fenris Wolf. Mallory's right. Some challenges you should never take. Especially from Loki. I frowned. Loki had used the term challenge too. Not fight. Not stop. He'd said, if you do insist on challenging me. TJ, isn't your dad the god of personal challenges and duels and whatnot? Exactly. TJ's voice was as stiff and flat as the hardtack bread he loved to eat. He pointed to the docks. Look, Sam and Alex have company. I hadn't noticed earlier, but lurking a few feet behind the children of Loki, leaning against the hood of his car in his jeans and teal work shirt, was my favorite supplier of fresh falafel sandwiches. Amir Fadlan, Samira's fiancé, had come to see us off. Chapter 7. We All Drown.
Wow, said Samira as we approached the dock. You're right, Alex. That ship is really yellow.
I sighed. Not you too. Alex grinned.
I vote we name it the Big Banana. All in favor?
Don't you dare, I said.
I love it.
Mallory said, throwing Alex a mooring line. Keenan Gunderson had emerged from below decks in an apparent truce, though both sported fresh black eyes.
It's decided then, bellowed Halfborn. The good ship, Mikkel Guller!
TJ scratched his head. There's an old Norse term for big banana?
Well, not exactly, Halfborn admitted. The Vikings never sailed far enough south to discover bananas. But Mikkel Guller means big yellow. That's close enough.
I looked skyward with a silent prayer. Frey,
God of Summer, Dad. Thanks for the boat. But could I suggest that forest green is also a great summery color? And please stop embarrassing me in front of my friends. Amen.
I climbed ashore and helped tie up the big yellow humiliation, my legs still wobbly from the rough river ride and my vision of Loki. If I felt this grateful to be back on dry land after only a few minutes of travel, our journey across the sea promised to be tons of fun.
Amir shook my hand. How are you, Magnus?
Even after all these months, he sometimes slipped and called me Jimmy. That was my bad. During the 2 years I'd been homeless, Amir and his dad had been one of my few dependable sources of hot meals. They'd given me leftovers from their restaurant in the transportation building food court. In exchange for their kindness, I hadn't trusted them with my real name. I still felt guilty about that.
Yeah, I'm good.
I realized I was deceiving him yet again. I mean, as good as can be expected, given that we're heading off on another dangerous quest. Samira nudged my ribs with the butt of her axe.
Hey, don't get him agitated. I've spent the past few days trying to convince Amir not to worry.
Alex smirked. And I've spent the past few days chaperoning them as she tried to convince him not to worry. It's been very cute. Samira blushed. She was dressed in her typical travel clothes. Leather boots, sturdy cargo pants fitted with two axes, a long-sleeved turtleneck, and a dark green jacket that complemented her magical hijab. The fabric of the headscarf rippled in the breeze, catching the colors from her surroundings and ready to go into full camouflage mode at a moment's notice. Sam's face, though, seemed a little off. Her lips were dry and peeling, her eyes sunken and dull like she was suffering from a vitamin deficiency.
You okay? I asked her.
Of course. I'm fine.
But I could smell the ketones on her breath. A stale, sour scent like lemons left out in the sun. It was the smell of someone who hadn't eaten in a while. I'd gotten used to that on the streets.
Nah, I decided. You're not okay.
She started to deny it, but Amir interceded.
Ramadan started 2 weeks ago, he said. We're both fasting.
Amir?
Sam protested.
Well, Magnus is a friend. He deserves to know.
Alex was working his jaw, trying to bite back his frustration.
Of course Alex had known. That's what he'd been talking about at Uncle Randolph's,
the reason Sam was having so much trouble focusing on her training. I didn't know much about Ramadan, but I knew a lot about going hungry. It can seriously mess up your concentration.
So, what are the rules about that? I asked.
It will not affect me on this quest, Sam promised. I didn't want to say anything because I didn't want anyone worrying. It's just no drinking or eating during daylight hours.
Or bathing, Amir said. Or cursing. Or smoking. Or violence.
Which is fine, Alex said, because our quests never involve violence.
Sam rolled her eyes.
I can still defend myself if attacked. It's only 1 month.
1 month? I asked.
I've done this every year since I was 10, Sam said. Believe me, it's no big deal.
It sounded like a pretty big deal to me, especially in the summer when the days were so long, and we'd be facing all sorts of life and death situations that would not wait until after regular business hours.
Couldn't you, like, take a rain check until after our quest?
She could, Amir said. That's allowable if you're traveling, or if fasting would be too dangerous, both of which are true in this case.
But she won't, Alex chimed in, because she is as stubborn as a very devout mule.
Sam poked Alex in the ribs.
Watch it, brother.
Ow, Alex complained. What happened to no violence?
I was defending myself, Sam said.
Hey, you all!
Halfborn called from the ship.
We're loaded up and ready to sail! What are you gabbing about? Come on!
I looked at Amir, as well-groomed as always, his clothes spotless and perfectly ironed, his dark hair cut to razor-straight perfection. You'd never guess he was a guy who was probably weak from hunger and thirst, but his facial muscles were more taut than usual. His gentle brown eyes kept blinking like he was expecting a drop of cold water to splash on his forehead. Amir was suffering, but it was from something that had nothing to do with Ramadan.
Just be careful, he pleaded. All of you. Magnus, I'd ask you to watch out for Samira, but if I did that, she would hit me with her axe.
I would never hit you with my axe, Sam said. Anyway, I'll be watching out for Magnus, not the other way around.
I'll watch out for Sam, Alex volunteered. That's what family is for, right? Amir blinked even more. I got the sense that he still wasn't sure what to make of Alex Fierro, Sam's green-haired, gender-fluid, half-sibling chaperone of doom.
Okay, Amir nodded.
Thanks. I couldn't help feeling guilty about Amir's anguish. Months ago, when he'd started seeing into Samira's weird double life as a Valkyrie of Odin, I'd healed his mind to keep him from going insane. Now his mortal eyes were permanently opened. Rather than living in blissful ignorance, he could see the earth giants that occasionally strolled down Commonwealth Avenue, the sea serpents that frolicked in the Charles River, and the Valkyries that flew overhead, bringing souls of fallen heroes to check in at the Hotel Valhalla. He could even see our huge Viking warship that looked like a heavily armed banana. We'll be careful, I told him. Besides, nobody would dare attack this ship. It's way too yellow.